Okay. Oh, I think that's everybody. Welcome. Go around and say hello to folks, starting with Ellen in Florida and Phil, Choketsu, Sandy, Mark W, Paulette, Marv, Sam, John, Sydney, Karen, Mary, Ken, Pat, Joan, Bob K, Chrissy, Soon, Jim, Bob O, Charles Lee, Candace, Angelia, and Ruth Ann. So welcome. Oh, let's see. In order for announcements, can't think of any in particular. Check the calendar for upcoming events. Oh yeah. Term student program starts in March. Check that out in the newsletter and or on the website. Yeah. I think that's it. Any questions or other announcements that people can think that I should make?
I'd like to make an announcement.
Oh, yes, Bob.
I'm starting a new group called the Zen Boys, and you have to wear a work, you know, a Zen work shirt when you go and demonstrate. And anybody who's interested can talk to me afterwards.
When you go and demonstrate?
Yeah, it's like the Proud Boys or the Bugaboo Boys, you know, they have a uniform. Hawaii, the Hawaiian shirt one works for me, but I'm from Hawaii and that it doesn't mean what it means to them. So, but anyway, I'm calling it the Zen Boys.
What kind of things are you going to demonstrate?
Well, I'm going to demonstrate how to lock and load, but not pull the trigger. You know, yeah, I
All
think.
right, well, if you're curious about what Bob means, go
See
ahead and
me
check it
later.
out.
So this is only for men, no women allowed.
Of course, come on.
What? Of course, what?
Of course, no women allowed. But why do you think we call it boys?
All right, so, but we're welcome to start the Zen girls as well.
I can demonstrate how to make a martini. Does that count as demonstrating?
What is the purpose of this new group?
Satire.
Yes, I think so.
I think we should leave that.
All right. Okay. So today, what I'm planning to present is something unusual. I was thinking about, usually the day before, I start thinking about what I'm going to talk about for the Dharma talk. And then I usually get up early on Sundays and put it together. But I wasn't coming up with something that seemed, I don't know, that was alive for me, that spoke for me. I considered doing a like a Q&A thing where you guys could let me know what you'd like me to talk about. And you're welcome to send me an email if you do have some thoughts on that. But I thought I would take the risk of sharing with you what is close to my heart. So, what I'm going to share with you today is basically about my climate activism, which I think many of you are aware that I'm involved in. And so what, when I present this, so I'm actually nervous. I'm nervous because this is like, these are like two areas of my life which have stayed largely separate. There's my Zen teacher life and there's my climate activism life, and they're aware of each other, but they're not integrated. And so when I present this today, I want to present it as this is what is close to your teacher's heart, and what your teacher is deeply, deeply concerned about. But I'm not presenting it as with the authority of a Zen teacher, if that makes sense. My authority as a Zen teacher is about other stuff, right, that I studied and I share. So in that sense, like, I really, what I want to make clear is that it's deeply important to me to share this with all of you, for all of you to hear this, because you are human beings and because I'm a human being. But it is not presented as, now this is official Bright Way Zen dogma and you swallow it and you believe in it or you agree with me or anything like that in order to participate. So that's always the tricky part, right? Zen has, and Buddhism of many kinds, but not all kinds of Buddhism, but Zen in particular has been notoriously unengaged throughout history in terms of social justice, in terms of social service, in terms of, you know, positive political change, all that kind of stuff. It's been very, you know, removed. Like, you can go off and act according to your conscience, and together we just study the Dharma and sit. And there's a strength and a weakness to that, because, you know, what does our practice really mean if we're not enacting it? What does our bodhisattva vow mean if we're not actually putting it into service? And to do that together. I mean, on the one hand, we say, oh, go off and do that independently. But on the other hand, what is Sangha for? Like, it's hard to go off and do things independently. And who better to do something with than a bunch of fellow Buddhists, right? But on the other side of the spectrum, you know, the Unitarian Universalists tend to be very, very socially engaged. So socially engaged that it's almost like, if you're not engaged, then you kind of don't belong. So I don't know. I don't know what kind of middle ground we can tread here. But I am going to take the risk of sharing with you what is really close to my heart. And we can have a very open discussion about it. And if you decide to drop off the Zoom partway through because you're like, I tuned in for a Dharma talk and this is not a Dharma talk, I understand. I will not take it personally. On the other hand, I you know, if you do stay with me, you know, we can talk about the Dharma of it. We can talk about what this means to us as Buddhists and how we might respond as Buddhists. So that said, I have a presentation for you. So I'm going to share my screen. So can folks see that? So let's see. I'm going to. So what I got this from, this is a streamlined, tailored just for you version of a talk, a public talk that Extinction Rebellion put together. So what it starts out as is really giving you the sobering facts. So stick with me, and then we'll have a moment for breathing. So the gist of it is that the climate emergency is much, much worse than almost any of us realize. And I would even include myself in that. It's too difficult for me to even get my brain around. I don't think I can't claim to have absorbed it. So just the gist, CO2 has been below 300 parts per million for 10 million years, since long before humans evolved. For the past 12,000 years, it's averaged 280 parts per million. Then, of course, we have the Industrial Revolution. In 2002, CO2 passed 367 parts per million, and today it's over 413 parts per million. So the best predictions show that we hit 560 parts per million as soon as 2045. And different models predict different things about what this is going to mean for us. So earlier models in 2007 said that was going to mean 3 degrees Celsius. And honestly, I think those of us in America should always talk about Fahrenheit, because Celsius makes it sound like it's too little. That's 5.4 degrees Fahrenheit average global heating. So now new supercomputer models say it's probably going to be more like 5 degrees Celsius or 9 degrees Fahrenheit average global heating. So it's average, and it's cooler over the oceans, which means inland, that means an 18 to 27 degree Fahrenheit heating. And then when you're talking about heat waves, then the spikes go up to about 36 degrees Fahrenheit. So 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels is generally considered the level where 99% of humans go extinct. So I'm just gonna stop the share for a second. This is hard to absorb. And the next slide in the show actually says something about, you know, these kinds of facts can cause a lot of responses in us. Overwhelm, sadness, anger, grief, numbness. This is what, you know, I've been talking about my way of viewing engaged Buddhism as being of three components. That's bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. So what we just did and what we're going to do a little more of is bearing witness. It's opening ourselves up to reality and suffering. And it's difficult. And it takes energy. And that is why we also take care. So what we're usually doing here on Sundays, what we're usually doing on Tuesdays, what we do when we sit Zazen is taking care. It's taking care of ourselves and our relationships and finding ways to be strong and to cope and all of that. But it's also, if we're going to do Bodhisattva practice, we also need to bear witness. And I would argue also that if we're going to survive, we need to bear witness. And there's a lot of cognitive dissonance right now in terms of, you know, if you contemplate some of this stuff, where do you put it? What do you do with it? You just go on with your life. I mean, I feel like I would be most authentic right now is if I began every every interaction I had with someone, even if we're just chatting over coffee or whatever, if I said, hold on, let us recall that we are heading for extinction. Like, I need to like preface that. Like this is my overarching concern, and it's going to have to become the overarching concern for a lot of us, or all of us. So deep breath. So that's where it said there's a lot of feelings can come up, and that is why in the way that I envision the balance, the careful balance of bearing witness and taking action and taking care we need to be really thoughtful about it, to be gentle with ourselves, but also not let ourselves off the hook. So right now the world is at, and this won't go on forever, I promise, 1.3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, and we're headed to 3 to 5 degrees Celsius or more. So the predictions are that 1 billion people will live in insufferable heat within 50 years. 820 million will not have enough to eat, or I think that might even be now. 3.7 billion will suffer from extreme drought. And as we know, people are being displaced by this. If you look behind almost every displacement or civil unrest, government takeovers, it's all being exacerbated right now by climate disruption. So we must stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius, because 2 degrees, massive food disruption, crops fail, migration and war. 3 degrees, economic collapse, everything else. 4 degrees is, you know, half the world would be uninhabitable for much of the year, and 5 degrees is all but a few million humans in the Arctic go extinct. And this is the last serious one. There's already about 2 degrees Celsius locked in because of feedback effects. So even if we stopped emitting CO2 tomorrow, it's still going to warm up quite a bit. So every year is a crucial year. This isn't something that we can put off. It's not something we can put off 10 years or 15 years. The longer we put it off, the more like precipitously we need to change. So this is a street art. They think it's by Banksy, but of course you never really know. And it appeared in London near an Extinction Rebellion when they first started doing their actions. And I think it is so that little symbol is the Extinction Rebellion symbol that the little child is planting. And I feel like that is the gist of the taking action part of my formulation of engaged Buddhism, because it is a medicine. When we start enacting our bodhisattva vow in a way, we can move past despair. So there's a lot of things going on in the world. I mean, there's a pandemic, and there's economic collapse, and there's racial inequity, and there's all other ways that we're like overexploiting the world and, you know, degrading our soils and pollution and everything. But if we don't stop emitting greenhouse gases, we're not going to have a chance to fix anything else. And nothing we've tried so far has worked. So this is, you know, this is how long this has been going on, right? The first international governmental panel on climate change with the UN, 1990, and a treaty and a protocol and a and the Paris Agreement, and like the CO2 is still just going up. So the gist of Extinction Rebellion in my work is that when the rules don't work, they must be broken by nonviolent civil disobedience. And we have great examples of this throughout our history. Over there on the left, of course, is Gandhi and Rosa Parks and MLK. And this is my favorite quote on nonviolent civil disobedience. So I'm going to read it out. So this is MLK's letter from Birmingham jail. He said, so as we want to keep in mind, right, in retrospect, we think, wow, Martin Luther King, so amazing, so inspiring, and the civil rights movement, so inspiring. But like, he wasn't so popular at the time. Even folks in his own church, even folks, other folks interested in civil rights were like, no, you shouldn't be doing this, you know, these sit-ins and these marches and stuff like that. You know, we should be negotiating, we shouldn't be making people upset, etc. So he says, you may well ask, why direct action? Why sit-ins, marches, and so forth? Isn't negotiation a better path? So in this case, we can think about, you know, isn't voting, you know, encouraging our parties to take more green action, you know, hoping for the new Green Deal, etc. You know, shouldn't we be doing that? You are quite right in calling for negotiation. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. It seeks to so dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. I have earnestly opposed violent tension. But there is a type of constructive, nonviolent tension which is necessary for growth. The purpose of our direct action program is to create a situation so crisis-packed that it will inevitably open the door to negotiation. So you can just look back at the last year for examples of this. Now, there's been issues with the racial justice demonstrations because there's ended up being violence along the edges. But, you know, in every nonviolent civil disobedience movement, you know, you can't control everybody. And the unfortunate thing is that the violent parts end up attracting all the attention and detracting from the mass of it, which is peaceful. And you think about all the things that our country has been called to reckon with over the last year that it was ignoring, right? So these people getting out in the street is what dramatized that tension and forced the conversation. So this is an article from The Guardian, a UK paper. So there's quite a endorsement of Extinction Rebellion, which is the nonviolent civil disobedience aimed at climate action. And even the doctors and lawyers and there's professional groups that basically say, yeah, Extinction Rebellion has the right idea. So this was a letter signed by over 1,000 qualified medical doctors. And they say specifically, governments abrogate their responsibility when pursuing grossly inadequate policies that risk environmental collapse. Nonviolent direct action then becomes the reasonable choice for responsible individuals. So, you know, incremental change, lobbying, legislation, all that kind of stuff, that's obviously mostly how we make change. But sometimes it's vast numbers of people getting out and saying enough is enough. Something has to change. So, of course, that's India, a Satyagraha movement over on the left, and a Black Lives Matter on the lower right. And then up in the upper right is Serbia. They overthrew a very violent dictator, Milosevic, around the late 90s. There was like a couple fires set or something, but this could have been the most bloody revolution, and it was almost entirely peaceful. So the movement that I'm part of, Extinction Rebellion, it's not the only thing out there, but we're aiming to prepare and mobilize people for that mass peaceful but strategic nonviolent civil disobedience at some point when we are able to show up in large enough numbers, or when the shit really hits the fan and people are ready, then we're ready to say, all right, we know what you should do. So the principles of nonviolent direct action, which in many ways, both nonviolent civil disobedience and Extinction Rebellion have principles that are very compatible with the Bodhisattva vow and with Buddhism. So it's respectful. It's not just physically nonviolent. It's also respectful and yet disruptive. It needs to get public and media attention. It needs to build some pressure, to build some kind of dilemma. It's more powerful when there's sacrifice involved, when the people participating are clearly making sacrifices in terms of time, energy, comfort, money, or risking arrest. And people will sympathize more with the cause because it doesn't look like you're just out there causing a ruckus for your own amusement. And then one of the reasons to employ nonviolence, which I'm sure we all agree with for moral reasons, but for strategic reasons, nonviolence also means more people can participate. Obviously, if it was an armed rebellion, there wouldn't be too many of us signing up, right? But nonviolence, okay, there still may be some risk involved, but a lot more of us can be involved. And if the authorities overreact, that usually only builds sympathy for your cause. So you wonder how many people need to be mobilized for this. You think you have to get like 50% of the population out in the street? And research says no. Research says if you got about 3.5% of the population really engaged in this kind of movement, change will happen. So that's still a lot of people, but it doesn't have to be everyone. Again, I would love for a whole bunch of you to follow up with this and want to join me with Extinction Rebellion. I would love for, if Extinction Rebellion gets to the point where it's organizing a mass action, that whether you think of yourself as part of it or not, you just show up, go to the state capitol, come to Washington, D.C., something. But I'm just going to present to you what we're about. So Extinction Rebellion, we have four demands. So that's part of the effectiveness of nonviolent civil disobedience as well, is that you're not just out there causing a ruckus. You have a point, you have demands, you have a plan. You create the dilemma, and then those who are opposing you can meet a demand and thereby relieve the pressure. So tell the truth, particularly by declaring a climate emergency and really meaning it. Acting now. So we have the halt biodiversity loss and reduce greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2025, net zero. That, of course, is like preposterous. That is just like not going to happen. And yet that's what needs to happen. So that's the goal that we're setting, because that's what actually needs to happen. So much of what we're doing right now are setting goals based on what is politically expedient, and that's not going to cut it. And one of the intriguing things about Extinction Rebellion is its focus on being beyond politics. So what are you going to do, right? So the government says, all right, fine, we'll negotiate. Then you're demanding that they create a citizens assembly. So I'm going to skip the fourth one for now, which is basically just taking it away outside the boundaries of just our country and realizing it has to be a global thing. So citizens assemblies, There's precedent for them. It's another kind of democracy. It's participatory democracy. It actually goes more back to the Greeks. Like, our representative system of democracy, you can definitely argue, is really not representative anymore. When we basically have candidates who are only concerned about being reelected, so they just pander to people and they don't make the decisions that really need to be made. So many limitations on our current system. So the idea is that there would be a citizens' assembly on the climate emergency. So you randomly select citizens, and then you put together an assembly that is representative across gender, across race, across socioeconomic level, you know, various other parameters that you decide are important. And then that group is, you know, that's their job, and they get paid and they get put up in a hotel, and their job is to hear from all sides, hear from experts and hear from stakeholders in the matter. And then, and they read submissions from the public, participate in facilitated deliberation in small groups. So it's a very different kind of process than our debating, like somebody's going to win and I'm just opposing you and we're debating. This is like, we have to come up with an answer. So therefore we have to talk to one another. And then draft and vote on recommendations, and then the governments implement the results. And so if the citizens' assemblies say something like, well, we're just going to have to cut down, you know, car sales or airplane flights or something, some very unpopular measure, but the citizens' assemblies say it has to happen, then you can see our politicians going like, oh, sorry, the citizens' assembly said it had to happen. Not my fault. So then, you know, we can kind of go around that problem in our system. So, and when I say why join the movement, I mean, I'm making the argument for Extinction Rebellion, of course, but I think this is true for any way that we end up taking action. Active hope, connection, meaning. So I hope I've conveyed some of that in my discussions about the taking action, the taking care and bearing witness, how really all of this ends up allowing us to be more fully present in our lives, be more authentic and fulfill our bodhisattva vow. So I'll wrap it up shortly, but I did want to show you some of the actions. So the kind of things that this looks like. So this is a Extinction Rebellion in the UK. They took over major intersections in London and basically shut down large portions of the city for better part of 2 weeks. And they got the government to declare a climate emergency. And I believe they also formed a citizens' assembly. So like, and they basically, Extinction Rebellion put the urgency of the climate emergency to some extent on the international consciousness. They brought it in a way that it hadn't been before, and it spread everywhere. So as you see, this is a picture from South Africa, and there's a little Extinction Rebellion sign on their symbol, on their sign. And this took place in Portland a year and a half or so ago, where they built a victory garden on the train tracks going to the Zenith oil terminal in North Portland, and occupied the tracks until they were arrested. This is one downtown that I participated in. We blocked off the street in front of City Hall for a better part of an afternoon. There was no arrests. They just let us stay there until we left. But, you know, when I first saw this fire truck, I was like, dang, that is cool. Here's parents and kids in, I think it's Scotland, in a national museum. So the little kids, there's other pictures of it where they're holding little signs like, I don't want to go extinct next, and various things like that. So it's a die-in is a typical action. And here's here's me and a bunch of folks on Hawthorne Boulevard on Halloween. And then, you know, not everybody's excited about that kind of thing like I am. But for every person that is willing to do something spicy or risk arrest, there are like 20 other people taking on other roles. Legal observer, snacks, decoration, transportation, speeches, songs, all this kind of stuff. So these massive actions, for instance, in London, took a whole lot of coordination and planning and support. They had big, you know, because there's just hundreds of people out in the street, parents and kids and professionals and working class folks. And so they had big tents where they were making food for people. So there were cooks out there making food as well. And then I just wanted to share, this was a, this is a subgroup within Extinction Rebellion, what they call the Red Rebels. And they basically do street theater, and they, there's a costume, there's instructions for how you do the costume, and in instructions you have to have at least 5 Red Rebels to go out and do an action, and they have to maintain complete silence as they're out there. They have a spokesperson along in case they need to interact with somebody, and they just, they all together, they do this kind of dance-like performance movement, and they're like mourning, and of course the sign of blood. So that's another example of like all the different ways that this can manifest. So these are just a list of the all the different ways that people can be involved. So that's what I've been working on. That's what I've been working on. In addition to my podcast, in addition to the Zen Center, over the last year. And we're working, we're really working on how to make this movement attractive to people, because we're not looking so much for people like, well, will you join this organization? The most important thing is just that people are willing to get out in the street when the time comes. Because even if everything goes great, fingers crossed, right? Fingers crossed, Biden and his administration take climate seriously, cancel pipelines, adopt something like the New Green Deal. But we also know our Senate is broken. And with the filibuster, it's unlikely that anything is really going to happen. I mean, or something might happen, but is it going to be to the degree that we need in order to prevent extinction? Very unlikely. So this is like, may you live in interesting times, right? If this was another, I would have loved nothing better than to spend my life focusing on the Zen Studies podcast and analyzing obscure scriptures and like just building a lovely Zen center. And I, you know, but that's not the time we live in. It's like we've looked around the world for so long and seen areas that are, you know, torn with war and strife and starvation and whatever. And those of us from this culture have just thought, well, you know, that's a bummer for those people. But this is really coming to all of us. This will be coming to all of us. And so really the question is, how soon do we act? We know now, right? We can't stop it. It's happening. We already see the results. I mean, I've lived in Portland for 30 years, and now I own 4 air purifiers. I never needed an air purifier before. I mean, it's insane. So yeah, but just to bring this back to practice a little bit, we can look at this as like, well, this is a bummer. It's a bummer to have to witness this. It's a bummer to feel responsible for doing something. It's a bummer to have to make the sacrifice to take the time and energy to do something. But a bodhisattva isn't bothered by that. A bodhisattva, it actually responding authentically to whatever is can be joyful and sustaining. And there's a lot to be learned and a lot to be enjoyed in engaging this. Like, and I would say, now it's tricky in COVID times. That's why our mobilization and Extinction Rebellion has been severely challenged by COVID, because the main reward of this kind of thing is the connections you make with people, is to get out there with other people who are waking up to the same reality and getting to know them and working with them. And that's all kind of limited in COVID, but we're making good use of Zoom. So I don't know. I guess I'll leave it there. You're welcome to ask questions specifically about Extinction Rebellion, or just, you know, comment or reflect more generally on your feelings and sense of the climate emergency or whatever. So looks like Ken had his hand raised already.
This might come out of left field. It probably will. But, okay, so in terms of Shot Community's perception of the world and the idea of the six realms, what happens in an extinction event if two of those realms don't have any more beings in them?
Well, in the Buddhist view, the universe is infinitely large. Shakyamuni is just the Buddha of our world.
So beings could just go to another world.
Well, maybe they can't go to another world, but there are beings in other worlds.
Okay. So no, like, life force actually gets extinguished.
You know, lives get extinguished.
Right.
And that's a source of sadness and grief. And I think about the fact that, you know, they say in Buddhism, no sentient beings, no Buddhas. There is no Buddhism if there aren't sentient beings. So I'm kind of concerned about the sentient beings, frankly. So on the one hand, we strive to save the sentient beings, but on the other hand, so that's why we always have these two sides. Then there's also that other side where, and that's what can give us the strength to face this kind of thing and to engage, because our, you know, we do have a grounding that says, well, like Thich Nhat Hanh said, our civilization may not last, but the Dharma is still there. Liveliness. I'd like to think of it as universal liveliness. So I don't want this to be an excuse for inaction in any way. But I personally, when I start to feel that despair and grief about what we might lose and what we are losing, you know, I guess I think about stardust. I think about tardigrades, those little tiny microscopic water bears that can like be shot into space and survive UV radiation. And like, so like that, the fact that life will prevail is a comfort. And yet let's try to save everything we can. Sandy.
I really think that the majority of people do not have much of an idea what exactly would happen. I think they're just looking at it generally, and all of us need to be educated more about what exactly is going to happen, such as the ice is going to melt and cause severe damage to land and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. We need to be more specific. We need to educate people specifically so they know. Ignorance is not bliss.
Well, and that's why I gave you an adapted version of our Heading for Extinction talk, but that's one of the reasons that Extinction Rebellion's primary gateway is offering this talk. And so what it does is it gives you like this kind of brutal refreshing. And every time I hear it, every time I look at it, even when I presented it today, I'm like, shit. So in a way we have to bear witness again and again, right? So then we present that, but then we present like, and what can you do? So we call it the Heading for Extinction and what you can do about it talk. So like it has to be translated into action or we'll just feel despair. But yeah, I think there's a lot of brilliant minds right now thinking about how to communicate reality to people, and they're really moving away from even when I started with, which is like the facts and pictures of polar bears on icebergs, because that's very abstract. But we need to have people understand more like, well, how is this going to impact you and your family? How is this is going to, how is it going to affect people? It's species centric, but frankly, that's what gets people motivated. Oh my goodness, you're talking about that. And like, for us, the wildfires and the smoke and the need for air purifiers and COVID as well is like, these are more visceral reminders of this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. Phil?
Did you happen to watch the Mind-Body Institute event with the Dalai Lama and Greta?
No.
Well, if you go to the Mind-Body Institute, I think you can still see it, but I found that very helpful. They had experts, and it was very well presented, and there were things that you can do at the end. So see if you can find that. I think you would enjoy that. And the same to everyone else.
Yeah, and in terms of the things that we can do, what I really believe and what many folks believe, especially those of us who are arguing for preparing for mass nonviolent civil disobedience, is that there has been an emphasis for the last 20, 30 years on the individual. So this is your fault. Because you consume so much and you use plastic and you fly, it's your fault, and therefore it's up to you. And this was like a very deliberate corporate approach. So there was like, they used to put Coke in returnable bottles, and then they started wanting to put them in like, disposables containers, and then the trash was showing up everywhere and people were like, oh no, and they were pressuring companies to stop doing this. And then the companies made the crying Indian ad, right, of like, oh, I'm so sad that you litter. So it's about littering, it's not about them generating all kinds of disposable shit, it's our fault we're littering. So it's like, there's truth to all of this, right? The choices that we make, what we buy, are important. But now we're living in a toxic system. And like correcting individual choices is not going to solve the problem. At this point, it is too late. If every single one of us stop flying, it's not going to change it. Because for every one of us, there's 1,000 people who aren't going to stop flying. So that's where I think like we need to radically shift our views about what's going to what's required, is that people immediately, and it's understandable, right? We want to feel like we have some sense of control. So we say, well, at least I recycle. Okay, that's good, but let's not get distracted by that. And that's not also not, rather than coming together to do what we need to do, let's not get divided over the purity of our lifestyles. Do you eat this way? Do you do that way? Do you buy organic? Do you blah, blah, blah? And then we're just, you know, we just fracture our own unity over these relatively small choices.
Domio, I have a comment. It's Joan. Yeah. You know, I've been to some meditation groups where the leaders were all bummed out over this and that and the war in the Middle East and so on. And the point is that I believe Buddhism teaches us, and I don't mean to be naive or anything, but it teaches us to respond and not react. And the thing is, I've also read a lot about in Buddhist practice is we do everything that's in our power to make our statements and try and make changes. But at some, but then we have to also have presence and know when it's beyond our, we've done this much, there's nothing more we can do. And if we start getting, as you said, despair and grief and so on, a person has to be cognizant of whether our ego is coming into it. Because if you think you can do, is it because everything I've done and it's not changing? And so if you, in order not to bring your ego into it, you need to get back to presence and just realize that you can't do anymore. Isn't that sort of a Buddhist practice?
Definitely. And honestly, I feel responsible. I'm really trying to get Extinction Rebellion fired up in our country. I want it to become a household name, and I want folks of all stripes, all walks of life, not people who just think of themselves as activists, to be ready to participate. But once I feel like that is taken care of, I don't know if it'll happen, but I feel like I have a lot to offer activists. You know, I feel like actually probably my time would be well spent talking to these activists who get very, you know, their egos get involved in it, they get burned out because they're trying so hard and they don't get the results that they want and all of this. So there's all kinds of wisdom in Buddhism that could really be helpful. And my favorite is Joanna Macy's idea of active hope, where you shift the focus from what you hope is going to happen. I hope that people get out in the street and we demand that the government take action before there's too much goes wrong and everybody's and it's great and we establish a great sustainable society. I hope that, right? But how hopeful am I that that is going to happen? And so one day I might be really hopeful, but then the next day I'm not hopeful. So that is that's not a very sustainable way to be, is to actually dwell on hope about what might happen. But instead, she said, active hope is about being active for what you hope for in the world. You know, so it brings that shift back to us. What can we do? I'm doing my best. I'm gonna go down fighting. That's all we can do. Paulette, and then Song? Mm-hmm.
How do we get involved in your organization?
Oh, Paulette, thank you for asking. So that I just put in the chat the link to our Act Now page, so that will explain more.
Do you have like monthly meetings or?
Yeah, there. Actually, on Mondays there's a kind of an intro session. There's one for the West Coast, time for the West Coast, and one time for the East Coast. And then there's other ways to get involved. The tricky thing is that, you know, what you really want is a local group, right, that you can go out and do actions with. But those are slow to develop. But come on, California ought to be able to pull it off, right?
Well, I looked it up and there's one in San Francisco, but I was just wondering.
And like we got a Portland group going and we're planning actions and we're happy to have like people participate in that discussion and maybe do similar actions wherever they are. So there are folks in Sacramento that are working on putting together actions. So
If you have information of about your group, I would like that.
About the Portland group in particular?
Yeah, I kind of want to make a bid for good old-fashioned political activism. Not necessarily what would have to be in the Zoom rooms now, but at the local level. I was a commissioner at the Tualatin Valley Water District for 4 years, starting in the year 2000. And during that time, mainly I ran because they were going to build a pipeline to the Willamette Water Treatment Plant down in Wilsonville. And there are fish deformities in that pool. And so they built a water treatment plant. I'm sure a lot of you saw in the news. And so I ran with another fellow to try to stop that from happening. We were successful. So they did not dig up, all the roads. So we're still drinking Bull Run water if you live in our area. But also, while I was there, I was at the gym at one of the parks, Tualatin Hills Park and Rec, and I flushed the toilet, and it's just flushing and flushing and flushing like mad. And, I saw some other issues with their facility. So I called the manager, I called the general manager at Tualatin Valley, and I said, hey, is there something we can do about the water wastage at the Tualatin Valley Parks, Park and Rec? And they said, well, okay, let's look into it. So eventually what they did is they did a study of all of their water usage, including all of their pools, the big swimming pools out in Raleigh Hills and stuff. So they found that there were millions of gallons of water being wasted. And this is, year after year after year, they had leakage, water waste, and they helped them change how they did things and help them repair some things. And basically, I made one phone call and saved millions upon millions of gallons of water with one phone call, because I spent $72 on a box of flyers and I filed for public office. So I've been on both sides of this. I've been out in the street protesting, but right now, Tualatin Valley Water District, back in 2013, the EPA developed guidelines for water districts to mitigate against the effects of climate change. And I just looked at the 120-page document, and our little water district is on page 20 as an example of an organization that's mitigating against the effects of climate change. Because at this point, it's going to happen. It's about how bad is it going to be. And so we need to make our institutions, our utilities, more resilient. And there's CPO. Washington County has a CPO if you live in unincorporated Washington County. There's lots of local city government. They have meetings going on. Our representatives have town halls. There's more than one way to skin a cat. And I'm just going to make look, Joe Biden just canceled the XL pipeline. So I'm just going to make a bid for you. You can get in the streets, but you can also get in the boardrooms. So
yeah, do both.
Get out of me.
Yeah, do both. So I think that's a great example of where one of the focuses of Extinction Rebellion is on government. We're not focused on, we'll criticize big fossil fuel corporations or whatever, but the real power for change comes through government. And, like I said, relative to the individual actions and stuff like that, that's where the real change can come. But hey, that's where there's just so many, different ways to be active. And as I was emphasizing in my taking action part of this Engaged Buddhism, is it's really like, it's before COVID, it was getting out of the house, but it's connecting with others. It's doing something tangible. It doesn't have to be huge, but something, some kind of action is just such a huge medicine, and it can take so many different forms. I pray, so if you go to xramerica.org/act now, one of the things you can do on there is sign the Rebel Pledge, which just means, like, you don't have to join Extinction Rebellion, just saying, like, all right, when you're calling for 10,000 people to go to Salem and demand change or whatever, let me know, because I might show up or help out. Like, so we're trying to get as many people to build a network of people who are willing to participate. So that's a little thing, right? But yeah, so many different ways. Local political stuff, as well as people have been pointing out, sorry to go a little long here, when we face this climate collapse, when we face these difficulties, we need our society to be as strong as possible. So everything that we can do to strengthen all the positive institutions, support people, build community, all these things are going to be essential. You know, so a strong Sangha, right? A strong Sangha is also going to be that. So these are not other kinds of activities. They are also in service of trying to, you know, make our whole society more resilient. So I would love to have a continued dialogue with people about how to bring this into our Sangha more often. I mean, we don't want to show up every Sunday and have to think about, you know, have to bear witness to how awful things are. But on the other hand, it feels weird to me to not acknowledge this stuff with some regularity. So I don't know. The balance is tricky. But I will close with our verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. And if you do want to get involved in Extinction Rebellion and join me, just let me know.
Thank you for the conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah, Christy, you're in the UK. That's where XR is, man. They're light years ahead of us over there.
Yeah. Part two of our conversation, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, have a good day, everybody.
Thank you. Thank you,
everyone. Bye.
Domio, you brung it.
You think so?
I think so.
It was funny how nervous I was. I was really nervous to.
Real nervous, but no, you did it great. Your heart was totally in it.
Well, and that's the thing, is you don't. This kind of change happens because people you know and care about and respect talk about it. You know, as you're finding out with the racial justice stuff, it's one thing to like hear a lecture, read something, or read an article or whatever, but it's when somebody you know and care about says, hey, you know what I'm really concerned about?
Yeah.
That's when it comes home. So
that's true.
Thank you. I was just trying to click in on all the things in the chat, all the notes. Oh. So, thank you again. Take care. Bye-bye.
Hi, have a good day.
You too.
In my days of being totally despaired and depressed, my mantra was, save the earth, kill yourself.
I know, that's, I feel like we gotta find another way to view humanity.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, can't I was do the... so... I remember one of the most touching things that I've ever experienced was at the Dharma camp. We had a Buddhist summer camp for kids. And one year we had a Native American elder come and do some activities with the kids. And I can't remember exactly what she did, but she invited everybody to say like where they were from, or I don't know, something connecting with their ancestors. And as is pretty typical, right? Like the kids, mostly white kids, are like, are kind of apologetic and, you know, whatever. And she was like, you know, you be proud of where you came from and your ancestry, and you belong to the earth. And just that mindset that like that maybe not all Native American cultures had, but that some did, indigenous cultures, we belong, we're part of it. We're not parasites and aliens.
Right.
I mean, what a beautiful, and it just makes me go like, oh. Cause I've spent most of my life similarly just thinking like, I'm just a plague on this planet.
Yeah, I know. Well, one of my vows is to be more like the earth.
Mm.
And what I'm thinking after your talk today is that, in fact, although there is no motivation as such, the earth is going to punish us for this. You know, the earth has no motivation like that. But I mean, it's a natural consequence of what we're doing. And I didn't think about it that way before. I thought about just being hospitable and friendly and, you know, welcoming and providing for people and so forth. But I didn't think it's like, you know, the downside of that is the earth could make it really tough.
Yeah. Always good to talk.
Okay. See ya.